Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did a self-described quiet and conservative young Texas woman match wits and wills with one of the strongest figures in 20th century American politics? The whirlwind courtship of Lady Bird Taylor and Lyndon Johnson set the stage for a shared life of political aspirations and deep, if not always easy, love. My guest today got to know Mrs. Johnson quite well in the years after her time in the White House, when she granted 47 oral history interviews to him and his colleagues as part of the LBJ Oral History Project. Michael L. Gillette went on to serve as director of the Center for Legislative Archives at the National Archives, and currently he is executive director of Humanities Texas in Austin. He shares Lady Bird Johnson's story largely in her own words in his new book, Lady Bird Johnson and Oral History. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So these were mostly recorded in Mrs. Johnson's living room at the LBJ Ranch?
That's right. The yellow sitting room, they called it. A very pleasant small room, and we didn't do all of them there, but we certainly did most of them in that room.
And what was the sort of before and after like? Was there a lot of chit chat, and then you got down to business, or how did that work?
Well, the preliminary preparation took a great deal of time. I had a staff that would go through all of the files, letters, diaries, appointment books, everything they could find, and we would assemble chronologies for each year, some of them running 30, 40, 50 pages long. And in addition to the chronologies, there would be background material, copies of these letters and her appointment calendars. And she would take all of that and review it, usually with me. Sometimes she would have reviewed it before I arrived, but we would sit down and sort of go over the material together, and she would identify the things that she remembered. She would also get out the photo albums that she kept for each year in that yellow sitting room, and that would remind her of things when she would look at the photo albums for each of those years. So we had a pretty good idea where we were going when we started recording each session. And sometimes we would devote an entire interview to a single year. Sometimes it would take us two or three sessions to cover a particularly busy or eventful year.
She comes across throughout the book as remarkably candid, not only about her husband and other notable people that she knew, but also about herself. Did she set down any ground rules regarding things she did not want to be asked about?
She really didn't. You could usually tell what her comfort level was in the preliminary session, and it was generally not her style to be harshly critical of other people. That's just not the way she was made. She would usually frame her characterizations in the most positive terms that she could, but at the same time, I think there was an intellectual honesty there, and she was fairly blunt about certainly her own shortcomings, and she said at times, for example, that LBJ was his own worst enemy.
Famously, LBJ fell for her just about at first sight. Let's listen to her talking about the first day that they spent together.
Sure.
I didn't know quite what to make of him.
Did you sense that magnitude?
I did, quite clearly. And I do believe before the day was over, he did ask me to marry him, and I thought he was just out of his mind. I mean, I'm a slow, considered sort of person generally, and certainly not given to quick conclusions, much rash behavior.
What do you think, am I right that they met accidentally, although mutual friends had thought that they ought to meet?
That's right. Jean Boehringer Lassiter had encouraged each to meet the other, and Mrs. Johnson, in fact, was given LBJ's phone number when she went to Washington just a couple of months before they did meet. She never called him. She had the company of a boyfriend from Texas who was working in Washington. So she had she certainly was focused on someone else at the time, but they met one afternoon at the Capitol when Mrs. Johnson happened to be in Austin to meet with an architect, and she wandered into Gene Boehringer Lassiter's office, and LBJ came in while she was there, and that was how they met. He asked her to have breakfast with her the next morning, and the rest is history.
Can you tell what, I mean, did she know exactly what drew him to her?
No, she. What she said was there was something electric going on, and mm-hmm. she could tell that he was asking a great number of questions about her, wanted to tell her all about himself, it was clear that he was very intensely interested in her. Her description of that courtship is about an hour and a half long.
Which is about as long as the courtship itself.
almost. And, of course, he ultimately gave her an ultimatum and just said, if you don't love me enough to marry me now, you never will, and I'll just be tormented. And so it created a terrible dilemma for her. She had to decide whether to marry him after this short courtship or let him go. And she said, the one thing that I was certain of was that I didn't want him to walk out of my life.
When she brought him home to meet her father, I love that her father said, well, you've brought home a lot of nice boys before, but this is a man.
Well, they were a lot alike in some ways. Mm-hmm. They were both large men and fairly substantial personalities that were forceful and authoritative. And I think T.J. Taylor certainly recognized the strength of Lyndon Johnson when he met him.
She lost her mother. Lady Bird lost her mother at a very young age. What kind of memories or impressions did she have of the years they did have together?
This was when she was 5 years old, and she had only the most impressionistic memories of her mother, being with her in the hospital in her mother's last days, and the pity that her mother took, seeing how dirty this little girl was, and knowing that her mother might not ever leave the hospital. The stories about her mother that she'd heard from relatives and others, really her memories of her aunt Effie are much stronger and of course lasted much, much longer, really for, 3 decades, really. So, and Effie was a much stronger force in Mrs. Johnson's life, even though Aunt Effie was a very weak personality, very frail, and she still spent a great deal of time with Lady Bird Johnson.
Was it in childhood that her love of nature and the outdoors took root?
It was. Being in that beautiful setting at Caddo Lake and the spectacular pine forests in the surrounding land, and Aunt Effie's love of nature and the walks that they would take together, the explorations that she would have alone as a little girl, I think that this no doubt made her appreciate the beauty of nature. And she said so many times that was a profound influence on her love of nature.
And her father had some money, Michael. Did she intend, so she went off to university, she went to UT. Did she intend to have a career?
You know, it's interesting. She had 2 degrees from the University of Texas. She had one in journalism, one in history. She had been associating with a lot of of journalists, reporters, and people who had studied journalism at UT. So that was, and she wrote feature stories for the paper. So that was clearly one career avenue. She also got a teaching certificate, and she took secretarial courses so that she could be a stenographer or a typist. And yet, when she graduated and had all of these skills, she really didn't have any definite career objective. She said, I was just going to go where fate led me. It was a very passive approach to a career, and Lyndon Johnson changed that.
Yeah, I was going to say, little did she know what was in store for her.
He supplied the one thing that was missing, and that was ambition.
Michael L. Gillette is with us. He's Executive Director of Humanities Texas and former Director of the LBJ Library's Oral History Project. We're speaking this hour about his new book, Lady Bird Johnson and Oral History. We'll talk to Michael some more in a few minutes. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. If you would like to show your support for Think, for KERA, for NPR and PRI, and you'd also like to receive a copy of Lady Bird Johnson and Oral History, you can give us a call now at 1-888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. The book is available with a thank you contribution, with a contribution of $120 a year or more. Jeff Whittington is here now. Hopefully your tongue is moving better than mine is right now.
When you make a gift or a contribution, however you want to characterize it, or
it's a
donation.
Yes.
To the station, we will thank you with a copy of Michael Gillette's new book, Lady Bird Johnson and Oral History. It's fascinating, and we're really excited to have him as our guest today. If you're enjoying this conversation, please call 888-694-6931 or make a contribution at kera.org. I want to thank, Donna Craig in Crossroads. Who says, I've been listening all my adult life to KERA. You cover stories that uplift and inform in a way that no other industry does. She loves Terry Gross. She loves Fresh Air. She loves This American Life. She says, I'm happy to contribute. It is well worth the money.
Wow, what kind words, and
thanks,
thank
Donna.
You for your gift, Donna. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number for you to make a contribution, or you can do this online. That's where we're hearing from folks when you make your contribution at kera.org, there's a little place on the form for you to say why you're giving money to the station.
Well, and people are giving a seven-word reason, because it's our seven-day drive, right? It's the first day of hopefully a seven-day drive. We heard from, Thomas Boyle in Dallas, who says, knowledge, information, discussion, stories, music, laughter, satisfaction. Well, Thomas, thank you very much for your contribution. Also want to thank Roberta and Mark Stansbury and Carrollton, Randy Wilson and Addison, Patricia Turpin and Cedar Hill, and Paula and Dave Folsom and Keller. And Chris, we heard from just under 200 people in the last hour in support of the station today. Don't forget, when you make your contribution, you're entered to win that iPad.
That's right. At the end of the day today, everyone who has made a contribution is in a drawing to win an iPad. Of course, your contribution allows you to win another great year of public radio content, great online content now, a really robust website that we have to offer you, getting bigger and better all the time. Thanks again to Tricia and Sam Dietz in Fort Worth, Terry and Lori Latson in Dallas. We have so many people to thank. Please understand that we won't be able to thank everybody individually, but that is a good thing for the station. Please know we are grateful to you from the bottom of our hearts, and your contribution really does make a difference, not only to your experience but to all of North Texas listening to this station.
Well, it's a good thing for you too, for us to have some people think that we might not get to your name, because it means the drive can end that much sooner. If you'd like to help us end this drive in 7 days, be entered to win an iPad and maybe pick up a copy of Michael Gillette's book. Call us 888-694-6931 or click and join at kera.org.
Back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Michael L. Gillette. He is Executive Director of Humanities Texas, former Director of the LBJ Library's Oral History Project, and of the Center for Legislative Archives at the National Archives. His new book is called Lady Bird Johnson and Oral History. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Michael, LBJ famously championed the Great Society. He passed the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. Were they fully aligned, LBJ and Lady Bird, in their attitudes about race and class?
Well, I think they were. I think they both personalized these issues. On civil rights, for example, they saw the discrimination that the African-American women who worked for them faced during the segregation years. Mrs. Johnson very often drove the car back and forth from Washington to Texas with Zephyr Wright or Helen Williams, and she saw the difficulty, experienced firsthand the difficulty that Zephyr Wright had just finding a place to stay or getting a meal. She was certainly sensitized to the problems of discrimination, and I think she may not have had the same just visceral feelings about poverty that LBJ had as a result of his time in Cotulla and his early years, but she certainly acquired that sense through osmosis, just living with him.
It's so interesting to me, the story about Lady Bird acquiring her name. Her birth name was Claudia, but nobody ever really called her that. But for the longest time, it was sort of considered unseemly for her to say, yes, I played with black girls in the neighborhood, and they were the ones who started calling me Lady Bird.
Yeah, that's what she told me, that it was really her two young playmates, the children of one of the staff, the servants that her father had, and one of them was named Doodlebug, and the other one was named Stuff. And Lady Bird acquired her name from those young children, but it was later decided, not by Mrs. Johnson, but by other adults, that it should be attributed to the adult nurse, Alice Tittle, an African-American woman also.
Were you ever able to find, I'm sure they didn't go by these names their whole lives, were you able to find Doodlebug and Stuff and ask them about their memories of her as a child?
No, I didn't. I certainly did interview some people that had known Mrs. Johnson when she was young, some of her former classmates, and a wonderful woman named Doris Powell, who was between the ages of Mrs. Johnson's mother and Mrs. Johnson. So she did know Mrs. Johnson's mother and had memories of her, and as well as Mrs. Johnson as a little girl. Doris Powell was really a lifelong friend of Lady Bird Johnson's.
Michael,
I interviewed a lot of her classmates, and she took me with her to her 50th high school reunion, and that was really an extraordinary experience.
Yeah, you may be one of the few men besides LBJ himself who can say that, technically speaking, you went on a date with Lady Bird Johnson.
Well, Liz Carpenter was along as well, so I don't know whether I was the chaperone or Liz was, but in the Secret Service. So she had plenty of company. But it was a wonderful experience, and we got to go to the Brick House and went out on Caddo Lake in these little John boats and really saw where her life had begun and that environment, and met all of her classmates, and that was really just a wonderful experience.
Did being there, seeing her there, did it bring out a side of her that, as comfortable as she seems to have been around people, that you didn't necessarily see in a more formal environment?
Well, that's a good question. She was certainly more casual when she was in an informal session setting. She was, I think, having been First Lady, she felt the need to be somewhat formal whenever she was speaking to a group or doing something that a first lady would do. But when she was hosting a dinner at home or at the ranch with old friends, she was very relaxed. And she, in fact, took on a more youthful demeanor. It was wonderful to see her reminisce with old friends about, you know, lives when they were young.
Was it understood from the very beginning of her relationship to LBJ that their lives would be spent in pursuit of political goals?
Well, not necessarily. I think that she certainly was surprised when someone told her or predicted that he would be running for Congress in a year or two. And I think her initial notion of politics was not a positive one. She said, she sent him a letter once and said, when they were dating, and said, I would hate for you to go into politics, because from her world in East Texas, it wasn't such a noble profession. It was public office was something that perhaps was often held by people that couldn't do anything else. And yet at the same time, she was impressed when she met a congressman. So I think that on the one hand, she loved the excitement of the political life that he provided. On the other hand, she is, as you know, was a very shy young woman, and it took a lot of courage for her to get accustomed to playing a role in that life.
And of course, those aspirations required a lot of moving around physically until apparently she decided to put her foot down. Here she talks about a house hunting trip with LBJ and future Texas Governor John Connally.
I said, Linda, when are you going to give him a check? And Linda said, well, we're not going to buy it. And I burst into tears, which were very angry tears, something I practically never did. And I said, all I've got to look forward to is one more damn campaign. And I really let him know what I thought of the 14 or so moves we had made. And the, let me see, how many years of marriage would that be by that time? From 30, about eight, mm-hmm. Close to eight. So he looked shocked. And John looked at him and kind of grinned and says, I think you better go back and buy that house.
How would you say, Michael, that the balance of power worked in their marital relationship?
Well, I think that he was very demanding in terms of, and very needy. She was very self-reliant. I think that she had to make a decision between being a congressional wife and a Senate wife who more or less had her own pursuits, stayed at home with the children, didn't participate in campaigns, didn't travel with him, didn't make him the number one priority, or a congressional wife who did. And she chose the latter route. I think that also influenced not only his success, but her emergence as a first lady who could campaign for her husband and who could do so many of the things that she did well when she was in the White House.
She was the first lady to hire her own press secretary?
That's right, Liz Carpenter.
Mm-hmm. And I guess all of this really deep engagement in his campaigns started with, first of all, she gave a lot of money, right, to run his first campaign.
She did. She asked her father for a loan against her part of her mother's estate of $10,000 to put into his first campaign when he ran for Congress.
And then when he went away to war, she took over management of the office.
She worked in the congressional office, and that really gave her an appreciation of his life and an understanding of how arduous his work days were, but it also gave her the confidence to know that she could work in that capacity. And the next year she went down and reorganized the radio station that they purchased.
Yeah, let's talk about that. She had quite a head for business, it turned out.
She did. She did, and I think she had very good judgment, and that was the quality that her husband really appreciated in her, perhaps as much as any other, the fact that he really relied on her judgment.
And LBJ would work himself to the point of exhaustion or illness, particularly when campaigning. How would she look after him in those times?
Well, she would try to ensure that he got one meal a day, try to help him relax and take care of any chores that she could to make his life easier. It wasn't easy because you're right. I mean, he did just campaign furiously every day, day in and day out, until he either won or lost. And often he ended up in the hospital during these campaigns.
Did he confide in her about the things that worried him with regard to campaigning or with regard to things he was working on in Congress?
Oh, I think he did. And he would also tell stories to her and to everyone else. You know, he was a great raconteur, and he would describe events that had gone on in his days. One of the great advantages of buying that house in Washington, in the Ellicott Heights, was that it gave her a place to host dinners and bring in all sorts of fellow members of Congress and their wives and later senators, first people like Sam Rayburn and then Richard Russell. And that really advanced Lyndon Johnson's career, the fact that he had years of socializing as a result of her hospitality with the people who could influence his career, his upward climb in politics.
Michael L. Gillette is with us. He's Executive Director of Humanities Texas and former director of the LBJ Library's Oral History Project. His new book is called Lady Bird Johnson and Oral History. We'll speak more with Michael in a few minutes. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email think@kera.org or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Before we go back to our conversation with Michael Gillette, we will remind you that we are raising money in our winter membership campaign. We're doing it online at kera.org, where we will read as they come in some of your seven words, your reasons for giving to KERA. Of course, you can also call us at 1-888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington is back, and you've got some seven words. That doesn't sound like a grammatical sentence.
I have some seven words. let's see. Sarah says, intelligent information to integrate into my life.
Nice.
That's very nice. And I like this one particularly. Ashley says, how I challenge my high school students.
Excellent.
With KERA. So, Sarah, Ashley, thank you so much. You can submit your seven-word, let's call them seven-word. They were saying seven-word sentence, but I'm gonna be a little grander and say, submit your seven-word essay.
Essay,
at kera.org. Or make the call, 888-694-6931. Or make that contribution on the support page at kera.org. And pick up your very own copy of Lady Bird Johnson, An Oral History, by our guest today, Michael L. Gillette. Fascinating book, and we're thrilled to have him as our guest. We'd be thrilled to send you your very own copy when you support the station today with a $120 contribution.
1-888-694-6931 is the number. KERA.org is the website, of course. You know, I really like this book, Jeff. I like to read about, official history down through time and the way mm-hmm. things have been done in politics. But I'm also curious about the real lives of these people that we know as political luminaries, as celebrities, what it's sort of like to be them. And I think this book does a great job at combining both of those things in a really interesting package. And very, you know, the vast majority of it is in her own words. It's sort of brought together with some essays and some perspective and context. But a great deal of it is questions. questions than answers.
Well, and these stories and the some of the recordings we're hearing during the show today really take me back because, you know, I know you don't have Texan grandparents, but some of these stories and her voice reminds me of my grandmother telling stories about, you know, growing up in East Texas and just the way people talked. You know, there's a lot of great stuff about how our society is becoming much more sophisticated and connected, and we're able to communicate with each other. But it's really nice to hear that voice and to hear these stories to kind of take us back to what Texas was like in the 30s and 40s, and then, you know, what life in Washington was like in the 50s and 60s. It's really awesome to be able to have this conversation today on the show. And you make it possible, folks, when you make a contribution at 888-694-6931 or when you contribute at kera.org.
It really is true that every contribution makes a difference. Today, every contribution we receive, everyone who gets in touch with us will be entered into this drawing at the end of the day for yet another iPad. So if you choose to make your gift to KERA today, you might just find yourself walking away with an iPad at the end of the day. Isn't that a great deal?
Yeah, it's pretty great.
And if you make a contribution at or above the $120 level, you can receive a copy of Lady Bird Johnson and Oral History, which really is a fascinating piece of work.
888-694-6931, online at kera.org. That contribution level, it's just $10 a month when you become a sustaining member of the station. You can set that up online at kera.org or on the phone at 888-694-6931. Of course, Mr. Gillette's book is out. It's available. You know, it's available online. It's available at a brick-and-mortar retailer in the area, I'm sure. And it's been very widely well-reviewed. And we're thrilled to have him as our guest today. We'd be thrilled to thank you when you make a contribution to the station by sending the book to you with our thanks.
You know that KERA brings you content that you can't find elsewhere, whether you get that content streaming online, whether you get it from the website, or whether you get it just over the good old-fashioned airwaves. KERA is unique, and it's part of your life. Please be part of the success of the station by making a contribution now at kera.org or over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Back with Michael Gillette to talk about Lady Bird Johnson in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Michael L. Gillette, who is Executive Director of Humanities Texas and former Director of the Center for Legislative Archives at the National Archives. In his capacity as Director of the LBJ Library's Oral History Project, he and his colleagues collected over 18 years, 47 different oral history interviews with Lady Bird Johnson. Many of those are included in his new book, Lady Bird Johnson and Oral History. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Michael, before the break, you were telling us about Lady Bird Johnson's hospitality, in some ways sort of greasing the wheels for LBJ's ascension in Congress. Let's listen to a little bit about how that house was furnished.
These two ladies, we have ever since referred to all of that furniture as the old lady's furniture. Their name I have forgotten. I went out there and one of them greeted me brightly and said, "Your husband's already been out here. And he's bought the living room set and the dining room set and the bedroom set." And I sort of staggered backwards and I said, "You mean John Conley, the other gentleman who told us about you all?" And he said, the lady said, "No, isn't your husband's name Lyndon Johnson?" And I said,
"Yes."
And it turned out that he had indeed, with us having no place in the world, put three extra sets of furniture, been out there, decided they were a bargain, and bought them. But then we hauled the furniture there, and I was just rocked by his audacity. But it just, I think it was not more than a week later that we found the house. So that problem all coalesced very well together.
I guess there were times, Michael, when LBJ would do things without necessarily checking in with her first. And famously, she was the one that often went around, and when he had ruffled other people's feathers, not just personally, but professionally, and she would go and smooth those feathers.
Well, that's right. And speaking of buying things without her knowledge or approval, the best example is the LBJ Ranch.
Right. What happened there? How did he break that news to her?
Well, it was presented as a fait accompli. He had negotiated with his widowed aunt to buy it, trade it for a house in Johnson City, and she said that he was so excited about it and so enthusiastic about having this ranch that she was reluctant to be too hard on him, but of course to her fell the duty of moving back to Austin in the following spring and renovating what was really a shell at the time. It had been badly dilapidated, but she took that on and restored it and made it their livable home and learned to love living in the hill country.
And I guess they had some really, you know, even in those early days when it was still under renovation, it was a place that felt really special to the family.
It did. And in LBJ's case, because it had been his aunt and uncle's, his more prosperous aunt and uncle's place, and really next to where he himself was born. In her case, because she grew to love the beauty of Central Texas and the hill country, really from the first time she saw Austin in the spring with the wildflowers. So the setting was very special to them.
Am I correct that the first time you sat down with her for an oral history interview was very soon after LBJ's death?
Well, that's true to an extent. I was asked by Liz Carpenter, in fact, to go out and spend an afternoon with Mrs. Johnson and Lucy and Linda the day, just a few days after the funeral, LBJ's funeral, to collect some stories for a eulogy book that Liz and I were working on. And that really began my association with her. That was January 1973. Mm-hmm. Our interviews didn't start until 77.
So it was just the start of building a relationship with
her. Mm-hmm. And she did arrange for me to come out to the ranch and interview some of her guests when she had some old friends from the New Deal period, Clifford and Virginia Durr. She invited me to come out and spend an afternoon interviewing them while they were in Texas.
What was the process like for her of rebuilding a life without the man she had worked so closely with for so many years?
Well, I think she was very lonely at first. Certainly, he had been such a central part of her life that his death created a vacuum, and there was a tremendous sense of loss, as there would be with losing any spouse. But she had a lot of friends, and she had a lot of family. She loved to travel, and she spent those next three decades doing a great deal of travel, and she became a world-class grandmother. She had a lot of wonderful grandchildren, and she would take trips with each of them. And then she became very involved in her community and, of course, the Wildflower Center. So the years after the White House were not exactly retirement for her. She was very busy and had a rich, full life in those years.
She was hard on herself with regard to her ability to always be there for her children and always be there for her husband. Can you talk about that?
Well, it was a very divided life, and not only that, but having one home in Washington and then having to pick up and move to Texas when Congress adjourned. So her life was split geographically as well as the sort of just being torn between husband and children. In her case, she made LBJ the priority. Now, fortunately for Linda and Lucy, there were surrogate mothers who really spent a great deal of time with the girls when they were young. Some were staff members or former staff members who were really like members of the family, Mary Rather and particularly Willie Day Taylor, who spent a great deal of time with the girls when they were young. And of course, the domestic staff that they had, Jean and Helen Williams and Zephyr Wright, they're all essentially members of the family. And so Mrs. Johnson had the luxury of leaving the girls with all of these people on whom she could rely.
Did either of the Johnsons really want LBJ to be president?
Well, I think that they certainly appreciated the opportunity and the experience. Mrs. Johnson regarded his just being nominated for president the first time he was nominated as a favored son as an honor, and she certainly shared his ambition. She was like he; she was ambitious. However, I think that she loved having him in the Senate, and she felt that I think he was at his happiest in that job, and it was a job that he handled so splendidly, and I think she hated to see him give that up, particularly for the vice presidency, which was not at all suitable for Lyndon Johnson. He was very restive and unhappy. While she, on the other hand, loved to travel. All the vice presidential trips were a great pleasure for her.
I'm curious, Michael, putting this book together, if anything occurred to you that you wished that you or someone had asked Lady Bird Johnson that you never did.
Oh, sure. There are a lot of things that that I wish we had been able to spend time with her on. One, for example, is really going day by day in that Lady Bird special train trip through the South in 1964. I wish we had gotten to do a session on that. There are all sorts of other things in retrospect that I would love to have asked her about, and that is really the challenge of oral history. How do you know what you don't know?
Hmm.
How do you know what is not written down anywhere that you need, that only the person can tell you? Absolutely.
Michael L. Gillette is Executive Director of Humanities Texas and former Director of the LBJ Library's Oral History Project and of the Center for Legislative Archives at the National Archives. His new book is called Lady Bird Johnson and Oral History. Michael, it's been lovely to have you with us. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to all of you listening today, and especially to those of you who are supporting KERA with contributions to our winter membership campaign. We say membership, it's a fundraising campaign, but being a member of KERA really is what we say. It gives you a special honored place in the group of people that make it possible for public radio to exist in North Texas. You can join this honored group at KERA.org or by calling in to 1-888-694-6931. You can choose to receive a copy of Lady Bird Johnson and Oral History if you choose to make a gift at or above the $120 level. Jeff Whittington is back with us now. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. So far today, we've heard from over 1,400 of you. Thank you so much. And about 276 people during the Think Show today. Don't forget, when you make your contribution right now at KERA.org or on the phone at 888-694-6931, we will enter you into a drawing for a free iPad. It's got the Retina display, 16 gig. This is not Chris Boyd's old iPad. All right, this is a fresh, brand new iPad right out of the box. And you could win that tonight. You can also, you know, you join that drawing online without making a contribution, but it's so easy for you to make a contribution and to feel good about the fact that you've supported KERA.
You know that this station really, it becomes a part of your life. It's different than other kinds. You know, you might tune into different TV stations and other radio stations. There's something about being a public radio listener that really ties you into a community of people who may be nothing like you in terms of where they live, where they worship, where they spend their weekends, but they are like you in that they are really curious and want to understand the world and explore things from a variety of different angles instead of going down a really narrow path of opinion.
Yeah, it's this station, this show, this kind of journalism opens the world to you every single day. And all you have to do is turn on the radio, or if you listen online anywhere in the world, just log in and tune in and enjoy it. And all we're asking you to do is a little something in return to help support the service that brings you so much. We are reading your 7-word essays. Margaret submitted one, Smart People Intelligently Discussing Topics That Matter. Thank
very
you very
nice.
Much, Margaret. Liz, her 7-word essay was KERA Motivates Me to Make a Difference.
I love that.
Hey, thank you so much. And we also heard, let's see, let me pull it up here, from Kay, who emailed her 7-word essay, Wrinkle Your Brain with KERA.
Very
I'm not
nice.
Sure that's 7? That's only 5 words.
That is how very efficient Kay is with words. I
thanks,
love it.
Kay. Bye, what? Kay. So I'll add those two.
Bye, Kay.
Thanks, Kay.
You can submit yours at kera.org when you make your contribution, or you can call us at 1-888-694-6931. We really appreciate you taking, it's not just the money, we also know it's the time. It's literally stopping your busy day for the 2 or 3 minutes that it takes to make your contribution, but it does really count for the station. And it puts you in wonderful company. We have heard from, 1,300 approximately?
1,400 plus.
1,400 plus so far today. So there are that many of you listening and responding. We totally appreciate that. We will need several thousand more before we finish all of this up. And you can make your contribution now and get us that much closer.
888-694-6931 on the web, kera.org. You can click and join there. This is all about doing this membership campaign in as few days as possible. Our goal is a 7-day membership drive. It's a new tradition. We want to wrap these drives up in 7 days or less, and we're well on our way today. Today's just the first day of the winter membership campaign, and tomorrow's Friday. So before you know it, it's going to be Monday, and we're going to be hoping to wrap the drive up in just a couple of days. So make your contribution right now. Do it today, and we will enter you to win this brand new iPad that we're giving away this evening. Call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. Of course, there will be other reasons for you to join tomorrow, but the iPad giveaway will not be one of them.
It's always nice to have something to look forward to sort of hope for. And, a drawing like this one is fantastic.
Yeah.
It would be nice to hear, I don't think we've heard today during the 2 hours of Think, from a Friends level member. It would be lovely to have a new friend sign on or to have a friend renew. This is the membership level that's $1,500 or more every year. If you do it monthly, it's $125 a month, which, even for people like Jeff and me, it at least sounds possible. You know, it doesn't sound like an impossible amount of money. If you are at a place in your life where you want to honor the station, really serve your community by making a contribution at this level, you can do it immediately at 1-888-694-6931. You can even do it online at kera.org.
Yeah, think about what you spend to stay informed. Think about what you spend on your television, whether it's satellite television or cable television. Think about the cost for your DSL line, if you have that at home. Think about what you spend on newspaper or magazine subscriptions. Think about what your phone bill that you use. You know, you get your texter out to check your Facebooker and all that stuff while you're walking around and more driving around, unfortunately, in our community. Think about what that costs you every month, and then realize that an affordable gift to KERA is just that, affordable, and probably much more affordable, certainly, than all those bills put together. We're not asking you to cover the whole budget here. We're just asking you to give something back to the station that gives you so much every single day. call 888-694-6931 or click and join at kera.org.
I always love to hear from those of you who listen to the show and use it almost like a recommended reading list, and we'll go out and some of you go to the library. A lot of you buy these books. You know, if you think about, even if you're buying them used or you're buying them in a digital edition, every one of them at a minimum would cost you $10, and a brand new hardback is like $25 or $35. Think about applying at least some of that amount of money into a KERA membership. And just, you know, check the books out at the library if you want to.
888-694-6931, online at kera.org. Don't forget, you're entered to win an iPad. The drawing's going to take place this evening. And if you didn't win that first iPad we gave away today, you're still entered to win the second one that's going to happen this evening. Call now, 888-694-6931, or click and join at kera.org.